Hey, welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and this is the little intro portion. So this episode is from the listener viewer mailbag. So someone sent in a few questions. I think it's roughly around withdrawal strategies and like actually retiring early. And I'm cheating a little bit because this is a rebroadcasted episode. I think we originally recorded it in like October of 2023. So this is one with Carl. A lot of people miss Carl Jensen, and boy, I miss him too. But this is a classic episode. This is one that we recorded back in Breckenridge, and we were actually working on the book at the time, the Lazy Book. And the Lazy Book is still a work in progress. And a lot of people were asking me about it in the last few weeks here. And we actually get consistent questions about the Lazy Book. A lot of people think that it might be available to buy. So people are asking, where can I give you money to buy the book? And I have to tell them, hey, it's not done yet. There's another group of people that think that the whole thing's a joke. And we never wrote anything, and we were just making it up. And it's a very long play, a very long gag, and there's no book at all. Truth is, we have probably 80% of the first draft done, but we haven't touched it in a long time. Carl and I were chatting in Cincinnati over a hot bowl of chili, and basically, I was like, hey, would it be cool with you if I work on the rest of the first draft, try to get it into a state where like maybe we could do something with it? And he said, sure, no problem. So that is probably something I'm going to do. I've had a little bit of a busy Q1 here in 2025 with actually a lot of vacation time. We went out to Death Valley and Joshua Tree a few weeks ago, and then I was out there in Cincinnati for Economy, which was an absolute blast. Side note, I recorded an episode with JT, who also attended Economy, about the introvert's guide to attending Economy. Now, the kind of cool thing is a few dozen people, well, but that might be an exaggeration, but more than one person said that they listened to the episode while we were at the conference, and they got some helpful information. The interesting portion of it is people got a lot of stuff out of it if they went to Economy, but on the download side, a lot of people skipped it, which is interesting. So it was like the people that listened to it, it really had an impact. They were able to tell me personally, and JT as well, that the episode was helpful, but many other people didn't check it out, which is totally fine. Side note, of the side note, I'm going on a huge tangent here, but this is the story time portion. Basically, I didn't follow any of the advice that I gave to other people for attending Economy. So I've been back here in Longmont for over a week. And a funny thing happens when I go to a conference. Number one, I talk too much and I drink too much. And then I lose my voice. So I didn't lose my voice over the weekend there, but it was pretty gravelly after one day. And the reason why it's very loud in many of the venues. And when you're chatting with people and you're excited to see all your friends and everything, you're talking louder and louder. And it's extremely loud, like to the point where people are wearing earplugs and stuff. And my voice doesn't hold up very well. So I kept doing that day over day over day, every single day, Thursday to Sunday night, I did that. So my voice gets worse after I get home. So it was actually like I couldn't talk at a normal volume from like Tuesday morning to like Saturday or something. I mean, it was pretty rough, pretty stupid. Number one, I have to record these podcasts occasionally. So literally the only thing I need to be able to do is talk. And I couldn't really do it, which, it's a nice little break, little vacation for me. But my voice is still a little gravelly, so I shouldn't even talk too loud here. So if you see me at a conference in the future, remind me, hey, you shouldn't be talking so much. You're going to lose your voice. Don't be an idiot. So, and you know, maybe I need to listen to my own episode because I literally did not follow any of the advice that I gave, including don't drink too much the first night. I did. It was really fun. Carl and Mindy sponsored the opening party thing at this nice brewery called Esoteric and really enjoyed it. Really fun. So thanks, Carl and Mindy, for doing that. And I think that's it for the intro. Again, fun episode. If you're interested in the book and you know you do want me to push this forward, and then when Carl can help out again, and I don't know, it might be like 2028 or something like that, we'll have a good starting point for us to re-collaborate and start working on it. So let me know. Shoot me an email if you are interested in the book. The other thing is we do have a sponsor, Ghostbed. They've been a great supporter. I was actually able to hang out with Rich Bernstein in Cincinnati for several hours. We, you know, you see people constantly in the lobby and in different areas, and you have lunch with them and all that kind of stuff. Love Ghostbed. We have the Ghostbed Lux. We have a queen size, and the Lux is a little bit softer. It has the nice cool layer in there, but they actually have many different options out there, so you could check it out. And one way to help narrow it down, because there are several options, you could take their 3-minute sleep quiz. So be sure to check that out. When I chatted with Rich, he mentioned that there might be a little bit of a change in the offer. So I won't mention anything, but I could tell you right now, you're going to get a great deal if you follow the link and you head over to Ghostbed. It should be at ghostbed.com/milehighfi. And like I said, we love our mattress. I actually have one of their pillows as well. It has like some cooling gel on top, which feels really nice and cool on my bald head. You know, there's no hair to get in the way. Thanks a lot to Ghostbed. Thanks for listening to this whole long intro. And if you dig story time, you know, leave a comment over there on YouTube or shoot me an email, because I do like mentioning some things that are just going on in my daily life. And I'll give you a teaser for the next one. I'm selling my truck. I'm finally selling my 2005 F-150. And I went through some of the calculations, which I'm happy to share later. And I am going through the process of trying to sell it on Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace, where there's a bazillion scammers out there trying to trick you as well. But luckily, I don't trust anyone. And I'm really skeptical. And I could just keep serving it back to them. It's a little bit of a waste of time, but it's somehow enjoyable for me. And solid chance I'm going to close the deal today. I'll be willing to share all the numbers and all that kind of stuff. And the thing is, I created the listing just yesterday. So hot market out there for 20-year-old used trucks. And the one other teaser I'll give you is I spent a lot of time on the copywriting. If you go look at listings, a lot of times it'll just say F-150, 2005, X number of miles. And then that's it. They don't say anything else. I wrote probably like two and a half pages. I told them everything that's wrong with it. I was like, here are the issues, blah, 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 blah. Take pictures of it so they know what they're walking up to. And then I paint a picture too. I mean, I'm telling them a long story, you know, things that don't matter, but it helps them create a little bit of a relationship with me. They're like, this is like a real person. This is not a scammer. So with all that said, let's send it to the episode.
Hello, world. Welcome to the Mile High Fi podcast. I'm Carl Jensen with my co-host.
I'm Doug Cunnington.
Doug, so today we're going to discuss questions submitted by our local Longmont friend, Austin. Austin wants to know more about what life in early retirement looks like, and more importantly, how folks draw down their savings. But before we get into that, I have a question for you. Did you ever ponder what your life would, and I guess I should back up a second. Whether or not we're retired is up for debate. We don't have formal jobs, but we both work kind of like right now. People could call this work. But when you left formal work after you got laid off from your job, did you ever consider what your life would look like in the future? I know you ramped up your side hustles. Is right now, right here, did you ever have any idea that you would be doing this?
No, not at all. I mean, I tapered down with the intensity that I was working, especially like right when I got laid off. Basically, I never thought about when I wasn't going to be working and what I was going to be doing, which I don't know why. When I think back, when I first got a job, I was in the consulting industry and I wasn't put on a project right away. So they literally pay you and you just stay home. Or at the time, that's what happened. So I worked on my house. So I always kept busy. So I think I probably just assume, there's a couple things you could work on. There's always like little projects you can do. But generally, the answer is no, I didn't think too far ahead. And currently, like we have a bunch of friends that don't have traditional jobs or don't work at all. So we have like plenty of examples to see like what people are actually doing when they don't have a corporate job. People fill up their time, it turns out. There's no like, I don't see many people sitting around bored.
No, it's super easy to fill up your time. And you hardly ever hear of people going back to work either. I can think of a couple mentions of it. I don't know these people personally. They would actually be pretty interesting to talk to. If you know someone like that in the audience, or if you are that person, let us know, because it would be interesting to see what drove you back to work.
I could think of two, not to derail us, but Robert and Carla.
Yeah, I guess they did take time off, but did they ever intend on retiring? Like, I know they did the Pacific Coast Trail, the PCT, and Carla's, I know Robert does work full-time. He actually works more than full-time now, I think 50 hours a week. But Carla, she's got another gig. I don't think it's quite full-time, is it?
No, I think you're right. I don't know how they framed it. I know they, I don't think Carla was going to go back. We should go listen to the interview we did with them and just talk to them. But I think she was doing like corporate law. So I don't think she was ever going to go back to that specifically. I think Robert left the door open, but they were like, they quit and had no specific plans to go back to work. That doesn't mean they weren't like, I'll never work again. But Robert, he seems to enjoy work and like all the pieces of it. And I don't know. I have heard of a couple of people that went back to work. And I don't know fucking why. Like, I have no idea. Robert's an anomaly. It's crazy.
Yeah, I'll say a couple of different things about them. One is that they don't have kids, so you've got a lot more time in your hands if you don't have kids. Like, after ours get out of school at 3 o'clock, I'm helping with math, and I'm taxi, like, always driving them around everywhere. So you have a lot less time. They don't have kids. The other thing I'd say is they both seem, like you alluded to, very happy with what they do. I know Robert loves his job, and I think Carla does, too. And I think it's a little bit different if you go back to work under their circumstances. I don't know if they were even necessarily bored by not working. I do think they genuinely enjoy what they do, even though they don't need the money. And they made a conscious choice to go back to work. It's not like coming out of school where you have to go to work to get money to support yourself and pay off your student loans and all that kind of stuff. I think it's a lot different when it's a pure choice like it is for them.
Right. And that's the thing, exactly. Like, they intentionally made the decision. And I think, again, you know what? We should have them on and we could ask, like, why the fuck would you go back to work? You don't actually need to. But one, the thing that jumps out at me is, like, even though Robert enjoys working, he travels quite a bit. And I got to think the opportunity cost is off. He's very smart. I'm sure he's making the perfect decision for him. But like, I'm thinking there must be something better that you could do with your time and money and effort versus like doing the work that he's doing. I think there's maybe some social like good that his work does. But at the same time, I'm just like, man, you could do something else. But that's just me.
No, that's a super good tangent. And that's actually something I think about all the time with people like Robert. Had they just not experimented enough and found like their true calling, like, what if he would have had a rule around it that he had to take 6 months off, not doing the PC, just sitting around his house? You wonder if something else would have come to him and he would have no longer wanted to go back to work, or maybe gone to work in a part-time situation.
Right. Yeah. So we could go on a whole tangent on that, but we'll have him back on. We just saw him the other day. So now we'll direct the same question at you. What did you think about as far as retirement in the future?
Yes. So, Doug, I think much like you, I didn't really consider it or ponder what the heck I'd be doing. I was just running away from a job I didn't like. And I actually remember the first day, my first full day, that wasn't a weekend, that I was off of work. I think my last day at work was a Thursday, so it was a Friday. And I remember going for a walk, and it was around a park near our house in downtown Longmont. And I remember looking around, and it was all young mothers pushing kids around in strollers, or senior citizens, like real-life retirees, or traditional retirees, I should say. It gave me a little bit of anxiety. I'm like, what have I done? What comes next with my life? I don't know. I've liberated myself from my job, but what am I going to do with my time? And it turns out now I've got 500 more things than I'll ever have time to do in my life, which I think is a very good problem. I never wanted to be bored, but yeah, what we're doing here right now is something I could have never predicted. So is owning the co-working space. Yeah, I could think of a million different things that I had no idea I would be doing, but it's also good. It's like this, I feel like I'm at one of those nasty buffets from our childhood. And I say nasty, and I liked those buffets where they've got all the like mashed potatoes and roast beef, and they've got the ice cream machine, and I just want it all. And as a kid, I did have it all, but as an adult, this buffet of life, I can't have it all. I got to be picky, but it's a good problem to have.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you said, it's a good problem to have. You have 500 things to do. You're still finishing a couple bathrooms, right?
That's right. I've got so close to being done with our master bath, and then I got to redo the girls' bath, but that'll be easy.
Yeah. We've all heard that before, but you're going to be done with this stuff eventually.
I think by the end of October, Doug, like 2 weeks.
Don't make promises you can't keep, but are you adding more stuff on top of it? So that's the thing that I observe with you, is like you keep adding more. You're like, oh, I should be done in October. And then you pick up a new thing for November. So are you, and I'm telling you, don't add more stuff for November.
I am adding more, but it's a good thing. No, Doug, you're going to appreciate this and like it. So I was out on my walk just now. I went for a walk before I recorded this. And the thought I had was, I'm going to record with Doug. And I've been pretty crappy at the podcast. I've been pretty crappy at the blog. And it's because it's been a side thing. It's been something I squeeze into my life because I've got all this other stuff going on. Like, I just finished this huge bathroom remodel that really consumed my life. It took like 40 hours to get the tile done because it was intricate. So I'm not going to add anything, but I'm going to expand on the things that I enjoy doing now but haven't given their due time. And I really look forward to it because I think if I actually made a little bit of an effort, I think at least I, Doug, you're a pro, but I am not. I think I could be better with the outlines, with the show notes, which I don't do half the time. And with the book too, I feel so energized knowing that I am almost truly done with all the stuff. I even outsourced the last big project I had, which is a railing, just so I could move on and get that stuff behind me and work on this stuff, which I would have enjoyed doing the railing, but I enjoy doing this more. Therefore, I need to subtract it more from my life. So, Doug, to be clear, I am not adding any other additional things, but I am going to, I do look forward to spending more time on the things we've already been working on. I hope that's a good answer for you.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Pretty good. And I think, yeah, the main thing is, like I said, you're like, I'm going to have some free time coming up. Let's go ahead and take on another project. Maybe you see a good deal for a house, you know, and you're like, maybe the time is right again. But you won't do that. Okay.
I absolutely will not do that. I will give you, if I buy another house, I'll say it right here, I'll give you $10,000 in cash.
Okay. That's a deal. I can get a nice guitar with that.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get on to the question from Austin, and really appreciate him sending this in. I'll read what I can here. It goes kind of deep, and we're going to break it down in a couple different areas, but one reason this is a great question is it forced us to do a little bit of research and thinking ahead of time, especially you, Carl. I mean, I had to think too, but you actually went through and made some great notes, but it's about the nuts and bolts that actually you and I haven't gotten into, even though you've been retired for 5+ years. Really, Mindy just went to work and then you haven't had to draw down on any of your investments at all, right?
Yeah, I actually did it for the first time to purchase a car. Should we talk about that now or save that for a different time?
No, let's save it for a different time, but I think people know what might be going on.
Cool. It's a cliffhanger.
Yeah. So I'll read this from Austin. I've been driving around Denver all day on deliveries and listening to a bunch of your podcasts. Definitely appreciate y'all's show lately. It seems like you have been upping the bar and getting some higher level guests. Thanks. We'll take that compliment. Give some specific examples of how people deal with FI and early retirement. Meaning, what exactly does it look like on a month-to-month and year-to-year basis? I always wonder exactly how people do it. And, you know, again, we haven't specifically had to draw down or, you know, think about it, but we have sort of graduated to the portion where we don't have traditional jobs anymore and we have a ton of freedom. So we could talk a little bit about that. And I know, Carl, there's a couple of examples that you came up with here.
Yeah. Do you think we should talk about these examples? We've got some specific people in here, but this is such a broad topic. And the main thing I think about it is it's not going to look the same for any two people, not the same at all, completely different. But I think there are some main points that we can talk about as well. But like the examples I had in here was where Eric, and he was on the podcast a while ago. And when he first stopped working, he immediately started doing handyman work for friends and other people. So he kind of gave himself another job, but it was a job he enjoyed much more than what he was doing. So I'm not sure. Can you really call him retired? Who knows? But he has since quit that, and now he is working on a webcomic he likes to draw. So he's doing what he truly loves, and so far he is making zero money at it. He's just doing it because he likes to do it.
And I think one thing to highlight, yeah, some people would be like, oh, that's not retired. He just changed jobs. But I think it would be similar for, like, you know, the path that you and I have taken. People would be like, from our old jobs, they'd be like, yeah, you kind of retired because you're not doing the same shit. No one's telling you what to do. So Eric, he was in finance, right? He was a mutual fund, like, numbers guy, right?
Yep.
We interviewed him, so people could check out that episode from way back. So going from that sort of high level career to handyman work, his peers would probably be like, what the fuck are you doing? And he could say, like, I retired from that. Now I'm just doing, you know, I'm self-employed. I'm doing what I want and I'm working when I want and I have, like, full autonomy. So I think some people can go along with that, but per the strictest definition of, like, not working, yeah, some people would be like, that's not retired.
Yeah. And the other example I have, which I think might be a perfect example, is Pete, Mr. Money Mustache himself. Because, like, that guy, if he doesn't want to do something, he is not going to do it. And I'm sure there's lots of things that people could point to on the blog, like him and I installed a heat pump at the HQ, and people could call that work. But we really enjoy that type of thing. We've replicated that same project in other people's homes. But the main thing, I think, with him is he's not going to do something if he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't plan anything. He just likes having his life an open book and doing things that come to him that he knows he'll enjoy. And that's pretty much it. Like, I was looking back through his blog the other day, and he used to write, like, every week, like, tons of blog posts. And now it's like once every 2 months, if we're lucky. He is just up. And it's because he doesn't want to do it. So he doesn't. If inspiration strikes, he'll do something. But otherwise, he doesn't write a word.
And I appreciate that too. I mean, it was probably, he was very enthusiastic when he first started blogging and he wanted to share ideas and just work on it. And then after whatever, 5 or 6 or 10 years, it's like, it's not as novel. It's not as interesting. And maybe he wants to do some other stuff with his time, which, even if it's just, I don't know what he does. He hangs around. Walks around, rides his bike everywhere. Yeah. He rides a bike all the time, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So, okay.
I've got one closing thought on this. I think maybe the litmus test for what you do in retirement and to know if you're successful or not should be if it feels forced. If something feels forced, if you don't want to do it, you shouldn't do it. Kind of like the Derek Sivers quote, if it's not a hell yes, it should be a no. So when I wake up, am I excited to work on the book that we're doing? Yes, I am. So therefore, I should do it. But anything I don't want to do, I should eliminate that. And I think if you're truly excited about your work and you're making money from it, like, more power to you. The internet retirement police might arrest you or whatever they do, call you out. But if that's your passion and that's what you're excited to get out of bed to do, who cares what anyone else thinks?
I think it shows you arrive too if people call you out. Like, no one's called me out for anything. You know what? I just wouldn't be aware of it.
It'll happen, Doug.
Yeah. We get it. I say it all the time because it cuts. It hurts when we get those negative reviews. People are just mean. And I think maybe that does mean we made it. They don't treat us like people.
Yeah, they treat us like animals.
Okay.
But we have feelings too, audience. We're
very fragile.
Yeah, you can be constructive with your criticism. You don't have to be mean, or you just don't have to listen. We're trying to help you out.
We if you do have complaints, leave YouTube comments. Helps the algorithm. So, okay, how do you want to wrap this up? You had some main points here.
Real quick, I think there's some main points to early retirement. In this, we're going to have, I think, maybe a 3 or 4 part series on happiness, Doug. I've actually started writing all these, and I think it'll be super good. But one of the things I've come to is a routine is super important. Like, you're going to have to do certain things in your life, like exercise, make food, get up and do all the things you have to do to take care of your life. If you have kids, that changes everything too. Like we alluded to before, kind of half your time is gone because they're around asking you to drive them around, and they need to eat and they need clothing, and they fight. You have to break up fights. So I don't... Eric once said, you're not truly financially independent until your kids are out of the house. And I think that might be the wrong wording, maybe like life independent, like you've got that restriction. And we all chose to have kids, so most of us did, so it's on us. This is going to be different for everyone. What makes you want to wake up and do stuff is not going to be the same for anyone else, and you have to figure that out for yourself, and that's difficult. Again, we'll talk more about that on our happiness episode. But then kind of a big one is things evolve over time. What makes you happy as a kid, from a teen to when you're a college student to when you're working to retired, it's different, and you have to be thoughtful and introspective and always considering that as you move through the phases of life. But again, we'll save all that for our happiness series, which will be coming up sometime.
And one thing as far as like how retirement can look different, we're in our 40s, right? You're in the tail end, you know, clearly you're a little older. But the thing is, I had my professional career from about 10 years. So I'm kind of looking at like 10-year segments of like how my interest has shifted. And I suspect it'll keep going because that's the way the last few decades have been. And I'm sure I'll get bored with some of the things I'm really interested in now. Like 10 years ago, I was spending a ton of time brewing beer and just like that whole subculture of like brewing beer, homebrew competitions, judging beer, breweries. And now I'm still interested, but not the same level that I was before. And I'm sure it'll shift in the future. Do you have similar observations of like what you are interested in and how it's changed over time? Or do kids just wreck the whole thing?
Kids don't wreck it. They just limit the amount of time that you're free to do these things. But yeah, it's completely changed for me. And I was thinking about this today. Actually, I used to be happy and excited to do these home projects, and they still give me a little bit of fulfillment. But now I've moved on, and I'm finally, like, you know, after 6.5 years of quitting my formal job, I'm okay with letting go of all these projects. I think it was because I was so high strung, and I had worked 40 or 50 hours a week at my job, then the same amount on the house, and then write the blog, and I published 3 times a week, and it took me these 6 years to wind it down. But now I absolutely love the thought that I don't have to do that anymore, and I could spend 2 hours a day at the gym listening to a podcast, doing weights, or walking around the track. I love that I'm going to be able to finally have the time to finish up the book we've been working on and work more on the podcast and see where we can take it. So and a year or two ago, these thoughts would have given me anxiety. I'm like, you need another project. Like, hence this house we bought that I probably should not have purchased. I'm not doing that again. Again, $10,000 to you, Doug, if I buy another house, another project house.
Yeah. And I was to that point, like I was just telling him, like, I've done so little like this year. I wonder you probably still think currently that I'm like super lazy, which is why I'm a great partner to write this book with you. But if you would have bumped into me those years when you were working like 100+ hours a week and you saw how little I was doing, you'd be like, what is wrong with this guy? He's not motivated to do anything. But really, I'm just well rested and I don't have the same, luckily I don't have the anxious tendencies that a lot of my friends are like that.
Yeah. I actually just assumed this whole time that you were in your basement there working on your side hustle. So all this is new to me. I knew your life was pretty carefree and a little bit less high strung than mine, but I didn't know it was that. But that's great. That's the reason you can put up with me. I can be difficult at times. So it works out. It's actually complimentary.
In the sound check, we were talking about paper notebooks and stuff like that. So I have this notebook here and there's like some sticky notes in here. It looks like it's used pretty well, right? So I brought this. It was in my backpack. The last time I wrote in it was a fucking month ago. And then before that, it was like another month. So this is just, it's kind of staged, like, I don't know. It looks like I'm busy, but I'm really not that busy.
It does look good. I saw that in the pages, like from here, are a little bit ruffled. So yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Just throw it on the ground, get some dirt on there. And yeah, it looks like I'm working really hard, but yeah, it's mostly blank. Okay. So Austin actually did write some good questions, and I can't believe we're so far in the episode and we haven't even read the first one yet. But did we close out the portion that you wanted to cover for this?
I think so. Okay. I have a lot more to say on all of that happiness and early retirement. I think it was funny, real quick, Doug, last Wednesday, I was in a hotel in California. The next day I was going to Camp Fi, and I woke up at 6:43 a.m. in the morning, and I'm like, oh my God, I think I figured out like all the pieces to happiness. I'm writing about it now and we'll talk about it soon. Yeah. Like I woke up and I think I was dreaming about it or something. I look at my watch, I'm like, holy shit, this is like an epiphany. So it's good.
So you actually wrote it down?
I did.
Wow. Okay. I can't wait to talk about it. I've been thinking a lot about it too. And we have even mentioned when we finish this first book and launch and get it out the door, I think like a practical guide to happiness with our spin on it. That's the next one. So
maybe it could be a good graphic novel. I know you said in the past on past podcasts that you're very skilled at drawing male genitalia, but I don't know how good you are at drawing anything else, but I guess you could draw people representations.
Yeah, you can. They all have personalities, and don't leave that notebook around. I'll just tell you that.
So a graphic novel for book two, stay tuned. But on happiness, it's going to be great.
Yeah. There's going to be a lot of characters in there. Okay. Back to Austin's email. So he says, I'm interested in people or how people are drawing down and not adding additional income streams other than passive income. So quick little note, he did use passive income in there. Almost nothing is passive. So even if someone like describes a business model and they're like, hey, this is passive, there usually is like setup and then ongoing maintenance. So it can be minimal, but almost nothing is passive. Can you think of anything that's really passive other than like index fund investing where you can literally like not do anything?
A mutual friend of ours, Boulder Steve, just has all his money in pure cash because he has enough where he can survive. Like he could just take the cash out, not count on it earning any interest, and live on that for the rest of his life. But yeah, hardly anything is truly passive. You're going to have to do some kind of, even with a 4% VT SAX portfolio, they're still rebalancing. You're going to have part of it in bonds and probably rebalance at least once per year.
Okay. So, okay. The heart of the question, we'll get into some of the details. And Austin gave us specific examples, maybe like people with real estate, people with index funds, and the drawdown strategy. So I'll ask the question. Carl, you're more the real estate guy, so I'll let you kind of answer it and then we'll go back and forth. So Austin says, how do people with paid off rental properties handle retirement income from those? Do they take monthly rental income payments? Do they reinvest some back into the properties? How do they actually manage this?
Yeah, so I think this one is pretty simple. We actually have a rental property now, and what we want to do is make sure our emergency fund is taken care of first. I think most seasoned landlords would have this. So you've got X amount of money to take care of a roof or a furnace or anything else that could go wrong. How much you want to keep in that is dependent on your level of risk tolerance. After that, most people would want to have a cash buffer for a vacancy. There might be a time where your unit or house is empty for like weeks or months. You want to be able to write over that part of your house, a vacancy. And then after that, most rents are paid monthly. I've never heard of anyone doing anything else. Sometimes you hear about someone who wants to go in there and pay you like a year's rent up front, and that could sound very appealing, but that's a big warning sign. Like maybe they want to have a meth lab in your basement or grow pot or do some unauthorized thing. So what they're trying to do is minimize interaction with you. So that can be a warning sign. So I would say the real basic and easy answer is I would suspect most landlords just live off that monthly rent payment. And I facilitate this through apartments.com, which is great. They have all kinds of tools on there and it is completely free, which is, yeah, super nice tool, apartments.com.
Do they market stuff to you or something? Like why it's not, nothing's free, right?
So what they do is they're kind of like PayPal. So if I pay you through PayPal, it'll take a couple days to get the money into your account unless I want to pay a fee. So if I pay you that fee to get the money in there instantly, PayPal makes money off that. If it takes a couple days, PayPal makes money off the float, all that cash they have sitting around waiting to get to its final destination. So I assume that's how they do that. And I think they have some other services you can pay for, like you can pay extra to have a fancier listing or more photos or something like that.
Cool. Do you have guidelines for the emergency fund and the buffer for vacancies?
The main thing I would say is if you have multiple properties, like you might want to keep X amount per house, but if you've got multiple properties, all the furnaces aren't probably going to go out on the houses simultaneously. So you could leverage that. And it's not going to be, if you have 10 houses, your emergency fund isn't going to be 10X one house. It might be 3X or 4X. Again, whatever you feel comfortable with. But yeah, I haven't really thought about any guidelines. I think it really is different for everyone. If you're in a place like Colorado where there's hail, maybe you want to account for a new roof if you don't have insurance that's going to cover that. I would say it depends on a lot of variables too. If you've got a new condo, there's probably going to be a lot less that can go wrong with that versus a house from the 80s where a lot of the mechanicals are older and it's got a yard and an exterior that you have to take care of. So I don't think, yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Pretty much.
Okay. Mindy wrote a book, right?
Yes.
It's probably about real estate, isn't it?
Yeah.
I bet it's in there. I bet there's some guideline, like a month and a half or some, like some ballpark. And then it's like, if your house is 100 years old, put more in there, right? So there's some guidelines out there, I bet. We just don't know them. Okay. It's okay if you don't know. So I think overall, as a person who doesn't have a real estate business or interest, it sounds like you just run it like a business. You can live off the cash flow. And our friends, Chris and Deb from Go Bucket Yourself, if I remember right, I'm pretty sure they did real estate and they have some cash flowing real estate. And that was their quickest path to retire early, but they don't have a desire to like have a huge portfolio. So they just have a few properties and it's what they need to go along with their other investments. So overall, if you have like real estate income, it's just like regular income. You run the business, reinvest if you want, make sure you have like some cash to deploy in case of emergencies. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, I would say so. If you're interested in real estate, maybe get a mentor.
Perfect. Okay. For the next part, Austin says, for people with, say, $1 million invested in index funds, what withdrawal strategies do they use? Do they take a monthly withdrawal or an annual withdrawal? Is it a variable percentage? Do you use the 4% rule? What do you do to start getting money out of there?
Yeah, interesting. If you're going to do this, the first thing you would have already thought of is how much you're going to take out per year. So let's just say we're doing the 4% rule on $1 million. So you're going to need about $40,000 your first year of retirement, or that's how much you're going to take out. The first thing I think, and again, we are not financial advisors. This is what we would do. We are not telling you to do this, but these are our ideas. The first thing I would do is turn off the dividend reinvestment. I think the dividend yield on BTSAX is currently about 1.5%. So let's say you've got $1 million in there. Turning off dividend reinvestment is going to give you about $15,000. So you're going to have to come up with $25,000 in additional money to live. And very simply, you're going to have to sell some of your assets. I think that gives people a lot of anxiety, and I don't think it should, because it's not like you're going to be, it's not like that mountain of money is going to be dwindling. And the reason is, The 4% rule, we've talked about this and for an infinite amount of time, that is the worst case scenario. So in most years, your portfolio is going to perform better than that. So you are going to sell 4% of it off, but at the end of the year, your dollar, your money pile should be bigger than what it was when you started.
You recently sold some stock, right?
I did.
Did you have anxiety, even though you know intellectually that it was okay?
I did. It gave me a lot of anxiety. But the funny thing is, Doug, and I found the same thing happens with me with big purchases. Like I bought the concert for $10,000 and going up to the point where I'm clicking the button, I'm putting all my information in, like putting the credit card number in for the concert or deciding which stocks I'm going to sell. I have a lot of anxiety. I'm like, oh, this doesn't feel right because I guess it's because I hardly ever do it. Spending is a skill just like investing, and so is selling your assets. But after I hit the submit button, I felt really good in both cases.
Cool.
I don't know if that was the question you even asked.
No, that is it. I mean, even though you know that like you should sell some stock so that you could buy something that you need.
Yeah.
It's still stressful.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty stressful. And that I actually just did that a week or two ago. And that was the first time we've ever done it, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cause in the past, I think you said, Mindy had some income coming in from selling a house, commission came in. So you were able to pay for vacation or whatever, some big expense that was coming up. So you haven't actually had to do it. And I think, I mean, the reason why is because we spend whatever, 40 years just accumulating and like, we're like, okay, stay the course. Like we're doing long-term planning. And now it's like, okay, now do the opposite. Just unravel this whole fucking thing. So that, I think that's why it would be a little stressful.
Yeah. And it's a quick pivot too. Like you said, we're saving, and then we're selling. And I think it's also maybe an acknowledgement of that we're growing old too. Like, ah, crap, I'm actually at that point in life too. It feels like another phase.
Yeah. You start getting colonoscopies all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Those are kind of fun though. I don't know if I had to sell stock or get a colonoscopy. I'm not sure which one I would choose.
Yeah, I think I know which one I would choose. But you know what? I'm going to have one coming up here. I'm about to turn 45. So yeah. Okay. So back on track here. So the first thing that you would do is to stop reinvesting the dividends.
Yes.
What's next?
So Austin also asked us about frequency. How often would you do it? And I think this is entirely personal. Some people might be better off selling all their stuff at the beginning of the year in one fell swoop, and then the cash is just sitting there. That's personally how I would do it because that causes me to pay less attention to my portfolio, which is a stupid activity. But other people, and I don't think my answer is the best because over time, the stock market goes up. Therefore, you should want all your money in there till the last possible second when you need it. So I think the more frequently you're willing to do it might be better, maybe on a monthly basis instead. But then that's just another thing you have to do. So I think it depends on the person. How would you do it, Doug?
Similar to you, I haven't had to do this before, but I think I would set up monthly, like an automatic sell, right? You could do that and then payout, right? To go to your checking account from your brokerage account. So that, I think that would be what I would do on a monthly basis, but I would probably make the decision at the beginning of the year or annually. It doesn't matter when, right? So annually make that decision based on, you know, what your plans are for the year and perhaps the stock market performance from the last year or recently. And then probably quarterly, right? Because I don't want to be in the portfolio like trying to make evaluations, like should I take money out? Like you set it up at the beginning, but I would have checkpoints quarterly just to be flexible, right? So there could be a big upswing or a big downswing that might change my decision, and we could change our decision. We don't have to stick to the thing that we decided in at the beginning of the year. And I think that's probably what I would do. That way you have a little bit more flexibility to be adaptable, but you have made the decision early on, and then you know you can stick with it.
I like one thing in particular that you said, and that is the automation part. So it's kind of like having a job where this money just magically shows up in your account, but right, you don't have the work part of it, and that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think some of our friends, I'm sure someone has told me, oh yeah, the money just goes to my checking account and then it's there. Maybe it was, did Brandon do this, Mad Scientist, where he was like, money goes in there and I have to spend all the money in that. He's experimenting with some spending. And does this ring a bell?
I know Mark Trotman does that for his fun bucket concept. I'm not sure about Brandon.
Okay. So if that's not true, sorry. But anyway, perhaps monthly is a good way to do it. Some people may do it annually. I haven't heard any other suggestions. It's usually monthly or annually is what people talk about. Yeah. Okay. And as far as the amount, so Austin wondered if you do a variable percentage or if you just use the 4% rule. What would you do, Carl?
Yeah, I guess it just depends on the needs for the year. If there's anything that's certain in early retirement, it's that life is uncertain. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean it in a super good way. It's pretty easy to plan a life where you're working and you might have like 3 or 4 weeks off of work every year. But when you're not working, all these things come up. Like we just went to Hawaii and we weren't really expecting to do that at the beginning of the year. It kind of came up and then we went on a helicopter ride and then this concert. None of these things I had planned for. So for us, I don't think we could automate it as well. Or if we did, we'd have to revisit it frequently and maybe up the money or take it back down depending on what our plans are.
Okay. And I think, I'm not sure how we're going to end up doing it, but one thing that we've been looking at a little bit more is the actual withdrawal strategies. And typically, you know, we talk about the 4% rule because it's the most popular, the easiest to understand. So news stories can cover it and then podcasters can talk about it ad nauseum. But typically, people are probably going to have varying expenses. And logically, if it's a down year, especially like early in your retirement, you're holding the risk of the sequence of returns, right? So if you have down years and you're taking out what is a higher percentage of than you intended because you're looking at like a fixed amount, say $40,000 a year, it could throw things off. So I think most people would end up having a variable percentage that they withdraw based on their plans and then the market performance. We're going to link up to the FI Calc app, which has maybe like 8 or 10 different withdrawal strategies. And they're explained fairly simply. Some of them are a constant amount, $40,000 a year, and then it goes up with inflation, or maybe it's 4%, or maybe it's something a little different, right? There's a lot of different varieties. Some of them say, hey, it's a minimum of say $20,000 a year, but never more than $100,000 if the market goes way up. So there's all these different ways that you can withdraw differently based on what your goals are and what you want to do. And they all have different pros and cons and ease of implementation versus like the maximum returns and all that kind of stuff. Have you gone deep into any of this?
I have not.
It's very fascinating, but it could be overly complicated versus just like we're saying, kind of look at the year, be a little flexible and know that some years you're going to be able to spend a little more, withdraw a little bit more because the market's up, or if the market's down, maybe a little less.
Sure.
So, but you can make it super complicated.
One other factor I'll talk about while we're on this topic, and I'll make it quick because we're going to talk about it a little bit more in a different context later on, is that in our case, for healthcare, we don't want to be on Medicaid, where if you don't draw any income, that's what you would be shoved into. I just don't like it. Healthcare is pretty weird in that there is not a wealth test. So you could have $10 million, and if you have no income, you're on public aid for health insurance. And I don't want to do that. So we always want to have some kind of income, and you could generate that through capital gains, so we don't have to be on Medicaid. But that's a whole other topic, where you're drawing your money from. And one point in that, I heard Sean Mullaney talk a little bit about this past weekend at Camp Fi, is you probably don't want to have all your money in an investment that wouldn't allow you to generate income. And you kind of need it anyway if you're going to be an early retiree. It's difficult to get your money out of a tax-sheltered thing like a 401k or something like that. It can be done, but it's complex. So think about where you're going to draw your money down to.
Mm-hmm. And actually, quick tangent. You mentioned you want to have some income, right? So that you're not on Medicare.
Yes. Medicaid.
Medicaid. Yeah. I always mix those up.
Me too.
I can't remember. I was talking to Elizabeth, right? And she basically, I was like, why didn't they name them different things? It's like naming two roads that are right next to each other. It's like one's court, one circle. It's like, fuck, just name it a different thing. Okay. The point is, what is the point? What was I going to? Okay. So you want to show some income, but let's say you're spending $90,000 a year in your household, right? How are you spending that money but not showing income?
Well, you would generate that. So how are you spending the money? But what was the question again?
How do you not have income if you're spending money?
I guess if you are in a situation where maybe you just have a big cash pile and you're living off that, like maybe you saved a bunch of money in mm-hmm. cash before you retired, in that case, you're going to have to sell something or generate income to stay off mm-hmm. Medicaid. And you said Medicare because you think I'm that old, Doug. I know what you're doing. It's a Freudian slip.
You mentioned that you guys are personally concerned that you don't want to show zero income, but that's not a risk because you're spending money, right?
Yes, and we don't have big cash reserves. So in our case, we are going to have to sell investments. But I mean, there's ways to, like, we could potentially sell investments that don't have a lot of capital gains that would still give us enough money to live off the year, but that would still keep us under Medicare. Like, we live in Boulder County, which is an expensive cost of living place for those calculations. So, mm-hmm. and I don't remember what exactly the number is, but I think if we didn't specifically try, we could find ourselves in a place where we didn't generate income. Like another one is if we just took the principal from past Roth contributions, which isn't taxable, we could do that now, even though we're not 59 and a half, just the contribution part, not any mm-hmm. growth on it. And that none of that is taxable.
Right. Okay. Yep. I always wonder that sometimes. And you actually told me a similar answer off the record once. So I was letting you shine there. Okay. Ready to get into a couple of the others here?
Yeah, let's do it.
What are some of examples of the withdrawal systems that early retirees use for predictable income? Do they set up automated transfers on a schedule, move money to checking as needed?
Yeah, Doug, I think you kind of nailed it with your past answer. You can go in there and automate it so money just shows up in your account. And it depends where you're getting your money from. If you've got the rental house, that money should just show up in your account too. There's ways to automate pretty much everything in modern life. And I think you should err on the side of doing that too. It gives you one less thing to think about and one less thing to log on to and have to do in life.
Yeah, there's probably some other options, but yeah, that's probably the simplest and that's usually the best way to do things. All right, next. How do retirees deal with required minimum distributions, RMDs, from retirement accounts like 401ks or traditional IRAs? Do they withdraw more than needed and invest the excess?
Yeah, so this is super interesting. I just learned this past weekend that the RMD age was raised to 75, and I think the average lifespan in America isn't that much older than that. So some of us won't have anything to worry about because we're just going to buy the farm before it becomes an issue. Let's talk about the healthcare issue again. If you need to generate income and reduce your chances of paying RMDs, you can do Roth conversions. And that means you're going to take your Roth IRA, or I'm sorry, your normal IRA or 401k and convert that to a Roth. So it becomes tax-free in the future, but you pay income tax on every dollar that you convert now. So if you really don't want to pay RMDs, if that's a way to get if that's really a concern for you, you could start doing those conversions right now.
And that's something we're going to be looking at when our income goes down, right? So once I taper down and our income is much lower, then we'll start making those. So just a transfer, is that a conversion? We'll just do the conversions over to Roth.
Yep. And I think the other thing to keep in mind with this too is RMDs start at 75, but you could start taking money from your accounts, I think, of a year when you turn 59. So that's 16 years of runway that you could just draw down your 401k, to meet, or your IRA to meet your spending needs, your annual spending needs. So why not do that as well? It keeps things pretty simple.
Nice. And then if you had excess, Carl, what would you do?
Yeah. So Austin asked this as well. I would just put it in a post-tax account. So if I had some RMD problem, I'm old and I have to take out $300,000 a year, then I guess it just goes to post-tax, or I buy a helicopter or some crazy thing.
Oh, do cool shit. Yeah.
We should go crazy.
Yeah. At that point, you know, you could put it in another account to grow more, but you're old. So I would say fucking spend that money, right?
Hell yeah.
What are you waiting for?
Yeah. Kids don't need it.
What tax strategies do early retirees employ? Do they use Roth conversion ladders and other methods to optimize taxes on withdrawals? And how do people make sure they don't withdraw too little and end up leaving excess savings?
Doug, that last one is a pretty good problem to have. Having too much money is what Austin is implying here. And if that happens, I think we can help people with that problem. If you have excess money, we'll send you our routing number and bank account number so you can wire it to us and we'll go buy a helicopter. Yeah, this is going to be different for everyone. And I think the main thing it depends on, Doug, is where you have your money. So if you have a ton of money in post-tax accounts versus having a bunch of money in tax sheltered accounts, that is going to change how you do things. Yeah, and there's things you can do for a post-tax account. I guess we can talk about that now. If you have so capital gains for a married couple start at about $90,000 and $45,000 for a single person. So one strategy that I learned about a couple of years ago that I didn't know existed is, and this is obvious, if you have a lot of capital gains but aren't going to bump up against that number, you could sell enough stuff to not have to pay capital gains and then just buy the same thing again. So you're resetting your cost basis, if that makes sense. So when it actually does come time to sell it, you're minimizing the amount of taxes you have to, you're going to pay. And that's called capital gains harvesting, I believe. Mad Scientist has a good article about that, which we'll link to.
I've heard of that. Yeah, that's pretty smart.
But if you had a ton of money in pre-tax stuff and you want to retire early, maybe you do need to do something like, a SEP plan or a 72T or a Roth conversion so you can get at that money before you're 59. So in that case, you would want to take money from your pre-tax investment instead of, if you don't have money in post-tax.
Can you describe the Roth conversion ladder? Like what mechanisms happen? How do you implement that?
So you're going to take money from your 401k and convert it to a Roth. And I believe, look up the details, we are not tax professionals or professionals in much of anything. So say you do $80,000 for 2024. You have to pay $80,000 in income tax for 2024. But I think you have to wait 5 years of time. After 5 years of time, you have access to that $80,000, even if you're not 59 and a half. Not anything it grows to. So if it grows to be $120,000, you can only access $80,000 of it. But that $80,000 could give you something to live on before you hit 59 and
kick. Okay. So it's like, it's still the same kind of rule where you can touch the principal, right? You could withdraw the principal.
Yes.
Okay. So it's the same idea. You're just converting it over, but you have to wait 5 years.
Yeah. So a lot of these plans you have to, it takes a lot of planning, like the separate but equal periodic payments. You have to, I think, declare exactly how much you're going to take out for the next 5 years. And again, look this up, go to madfiantist.com. Or your tax professional. So they take a lot of planning. You kind of have to know how much you're going to need to spend in the future. But if you can do that, you can have access to your pre-tax income ahead of time or your pre-tax investments. And someone made the case, this was actually on Mad Scientist, is that there's a 10% penalty hit if you access these funds ahead of time. So if you just took a withdrawal from your 401k now, you'd have to pay a 10% penalty. But this guy made the case that it might even be worthwhile to do that because the 401k saved you from a much higher tax rate than that. I can't remember what these are called, like marginal tax rate or whatever. But any dollar you put into your 401k was taxes you didn't have to pay from the top tax tier. So especially if you're making a lot of money, you saved yourself like 25 or 29 or whatever your tax rate is. So it might be worthwhile to just take the hit and grab that money without doing anything exotic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So someone could get at the money a little bit early. I personally, like, I wasn't aware of this whole world or the fact that you could get to that pre-tax money sooner. I didn't know there were mechanisms, even though you have to jump through some hoops and all that. So once Elizabeth and I decided that we didn't want to wait and we didn't want to wait to get to that money, we were just like, okay, we need to invest in a brokerage account and have flexibility. So we lost some of the tax benefits. We paid more taxes for flexibility, right? So everyone has to make their own decision. And there is a case also, like if you look at the right years, I'm pretty sure if I just would have invested and maxed out everything in the 401ks, I would have come out ahead because the market grew so much in those years. It's not like that all the time. It just happened to be that decade or whatever that was really on fire. I didn't know it at the time. No one did, right? But the point is you have a huge amount of flexibility with the post-tax brokerage accounts. And the amount that we have invested in the pre-tax IRAs or traditional IRAs and all that stuff, it will be very sizable by the time we hit 59 and a half. So it seems, actually, we got some hate mail, like, hey, Doug, you shouldn't tell people not to invest in those, but there are specific reasons why you might consider it. It's not right for everyone, but we made that decision. It maybe wasn't the best decision if we look back, but it was fine and everything's fine. And we have a lot of flexibility now.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that's probably underappreciated. So if we think of it, there's three different buckets. One is a pre-tax 401k. Another one is a pre-tax Roth investment. And another one is just the brokerage account. But each of those accounts have distinct advantages. Like the Roth, you could take your principal before you're 59 and a half, but you can't get at the rest. The 401k, you can't do anything with unless you want to do one of these complicated tax things. But the post-tax brokerage, it's kind of like a Roth because unless you two take a whole bunch of money out, like you could probably take, let's say you put $90,000 in there and it grows to $180,000. You could take that whole $180,000 out, assuming there's no other income, and not pay any taxes on it because you're still under that capital gains rule, the capital gains limit. And then there's the standard deduction and all that. So I think the post-tax brokerage account is never talked about in the FI community, but I think it's underappreciated. And as long as you don't have some crazy ass lifestyle, you're probably not going to pay taxes on it either. You'll pay the taxes up front, just like a Roth, but you're not going to pay them on the back end. And like you said, it gives you another lever to pull for flexibility.
And one that we really didn't get into, I mean, so HSA, do you guys have an HSA?
Yes.
Okay. And that one gets like even better tax benefits, right?
Yeah, I think that's like tax-free on both sides. So yeah. You save a little bit of income tax, and then when you use it, you don't have to pay any taxes either. It's great.
And we weren't aware until the last few years, and when I started consuming a lot more, you know, fire content and stuff, and I was like, oh yeah, we should do this. So we got started a little too late, but luckily our other buckets are pretty good. But I mean, that would be another distinct fourth bucket, right?
Yeah, and HSA is great. Pretty sure I should know this, but you can get at the money after a certain age, even if you don't use it for health stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. See your tax professional again. Don't trust us.
But yeah.
Yeah. I took our HSA and we had a flexible one and I bought a bunch of Tesla stocks. So our HSA is kind of substantial. So I'm going to have to come down with some kind of good chronic diseases to spend it down, I think.
Wow. That's great. That's like having like a huge investment in your Roth, you know?
Yeah, kind of. I guess as long as we can get at it without being sick, because I prefer not to get sick.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, not worth the cost. Okay, so I think we covered that pretty well. Next is ending up with excess savings. And Carl, you mentioned that's a good problem to have. And I say go to a pro. Go to an advisor. And a year ago, if you would ask me 6 months ago, I probably wouldn't have said, go to an advisor. Even when I hear some of our friends are like, oh yeah, like when you are starting to plan like further out, then you probably need to go to a pro who knows what's going on and like certain checkpoints that you need to take a look at. Elizabeth and I personally met with Travis and Eddie, our friends over at Downshift Financial, and the thing is, you know, they're fee-based. They're not assets under management. So those are the folks you have to look out for. You should be, I think there's websites with directories so you could find someone that you want to work with. And the thing is, the pros see this all the time. So they can look at your balance sheet and they know certain checkpoints that you need to pay attention to in general and say, hey, you know, you have RMDs are going to be a problem if you don't start doing things a little bit sooner. Like you said, you got 16 years, so it's not going to sneak up on you. But if you're not paying attention, you know, maybe you're getting older, you forget stuff all the time. So if you go to a pro, they can help you out and guide you. And like I said, I'm surprised that I've like changed my tune on that. But I heard advisors like Joe Saul Sehy, he mentions this every now and then, Stacking Benjamins. You know, he's a former financial advisor. And it's like, when you actually start planning, like once we're past the 4% rule and you're trying to make a plan for like 45 years, you might need someone to take a look at it that's not just in your circle of friends, right? Who's like, hey, it looks good to me. You got a lot of money.
Yeah, Doug, I think you make a really good point. And I've come around to this too, so much so that Mindy and I actually are going to hire someone to look over our stuff. It's not going to be as in-depth as you, but we want to make sure there's no optimization. So I think where a fee-based advisor might not make as much sense, or an advisor might not make as much sense as when you're young. It's going to be a more significant proportion of your savings and all that. So you're going to pay a lot more for it. And things are pretty simple when you're young. Let's just max out our 401k. But as we get older, it gets a lot more complicated, right? And especially there's the investment part, but then there's the life part too. When you disengage from a job, you're not going to have the income. So you're going to have to depend on that money. Like if an advisor might be able to give you one piece of advice that could save you maybe hundreds of thousands over the long term, just a tweak to what you're doing, like maybe taking money out from the 401k to avoid those RMDs later on or something like that. But, and like, I know Eddie and Travis, those guys are super smart. They talk on our Discord and I know those guys know what they're doing. So I've come around to this too. While we won't go to the same level as you, I think it's definitely worthwhile, especially if you've got all these different buckets to have someone look at. Hey, I've got 1/3 in brokerage. I've got 1/8 in a Roth. Like, is this where we should be? And if not, what could we do to optimize it?
Yeah, exactly. And that's a great example. We just kind of lucked out. We kind of have the right proportions in the various buckets. And it was kind of dumb luck. I mean, we planned ahead and it worked out okay. But like, if we had all of our money, all of our nest egg in pre-tax, we would have to fucking figure out how to get it out. And it's not, I mean, there's things you could do, but it's not a slam dunk. Like the Roth conversion ladder, 5 years, right? Like we would have had to take a penalty basically, or keep working for 5 years.
Yeah.
So, okay.
And those investments, those kind of instruments are complicated too. So a tax professional is going to be able to guide you through them and sign off on it so you don't mess anything up, which is critical. You don't want to have the IRS sending you letters in the mail.
Yeah.
One other thing I want to go back to real quick is we talked about the excess savings. And one thing people could do is support our podcast over on Buy Me a Coffee. One thing we did, we have Chris, who very kindly volunteered to help us out. He wouldn't take money from us. So one of the things we did with our proceeds from the Buy Me a Coffee is we bought him a Camp Fi weekend. So I just met him for the first time. Super great guy. His wife made me a Taylor Swift t-shirt, which I'll wear on a future episode. So it would be nice to cover the cost and to be able to pay people to make this podcast a little bit better. Maybe edit it so I don't sound so stupid too.
There's only so much that editing can do. You also get extra content over on Buy Me a Coffee. So we've been recording videos of progress of the book that we're writing, and we release those early, and then people at Buy Me a Coffee get to see it. We also we just do post occasionally. We're not super regular with it, but we do post some extra content out there. The other thing that we end up doing, one reason we're in the hole, we're just nice people and generous, as everyone knows, but we buy t-shirts and we just give them out Like there's some, like a couple people have purchased t-shirts and we really appreciate it, but there's not that many. We usually just buy stuff and give it away. And we just got a, I got a batch of stickers and you were giving some out. There's some special edition asparagus ones as well. Yeah.
It's surprisingly enough, Doug, I was telling Doug about this offline. I put all three equal amounts of all three stickers out. And I think, I forgot, were the asparagus ones the most popular? I think they might have been, which surprised me.
Yeah. Or I thought you said the ones with our face on there.
Oh, yeah. And maybe that's why I was surprised.
I was surprised too.
Yeah, I was unsure who'd want that. But another thing, Doug, is we just bought a Cricut machine, if people are familiar with that. So I have all these ideas for custom swag. And what we're going to do when we come out with a book for Buy Me a Coffee supporters, we're going to have packages where you get a book and maybe a t-shirt, maybe an old school one, or maybe even like a custom one that's a one-off or a five-off. Yeah. And we've got some pretty cool ideas around that. And that machine's supposed to show up Sunday, I think, all in, like, I spent $600 on all that stuff. But
oh, you did?
Yeah. Wow. We could make some.
Yeah.
So Doug, real quick, I ordered a bunch of, like, the tri-blend I could sell to Doug. I'm into good t-shirts, too, but Doug is into it more than me, so I could sell to Doug. He told me, what t-shirts do you get back? Doug, we need to come up with swag that no one else has. And I'm thinking, I don't know if they have this, but like tri-blend underwear, and then we could have mile hi-fi, like boxers, or like maybe thongs, if that's what you're into, or whatever. A thong wouldn't give us that much real estate to put our logo on, but we could, maybe on the front, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, probably in the front. That makes sense. It's real odd to end on this note.
It is odd, but Doug, I just love the idea. Like some people have diversified into socks. And it's kind of a statement for us. Like, we're not trying to advertise because a t-shirt like socks, other people see it. We're just trying to give you something you need. So here's Mile Hi-Fi underwear. Imagine the surprise on your partner's face when you disrobe and there's a fluorescent biplane on your private parts.
Yeah, that will be shocking.
It'll be great. Okay, let's end on that note.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer. This show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. So we're out here in the mountains writing again. And we have a similar setup where we're like sitting at a table across from each other. And I noticed, well, it's a fucking mess. First of all, there's like wires everywhere. We're recording. So, I mean, there's headphones, there's microphones, there's like a million USB cables. I'm sure we're violating some kind of fire code with all the daisy chained, just electrical sockets we have going on. But there's also a lot of paper notebooks. So I like to write by hand. I see you have a couple actually. So do you prefer like a paper notebook versus like writing your notes or whatever in an app?
Yeah, that is a great question, Doug. I'll show you my first notebook. Did you wonder why I had a Hello Kitty notebook at all? Or
I've seen that a couple times, but you know what? I just thought it was something that was really important to you.
No, Hello Kitty is actually not really important to me. I don't care for, or I don't dislike Hello Kitty. I just don't know much about her or him. I guess it's a her because she has a bow, but okay, I'm going down a rabbit hole or maybe a cat hole that I shouldn't go down. Yeah, this was free. They had a free rack at the Longmont Library where people can dump off their old magazines and books, and this was on there. It had not been touched. So I grabbed it, and I do like writing. It's nice to have. by the side of the bed. Sometimes I'll have ideas before I go to sleep, and I don't like having my phone or an electronic device. And it's just something I can have in my bag, which I take with me at all times. And yeah, I do like the written word and writing. I'm curious, what is the appeal of it to you?
Probably a little similar. I get distracted, you know, with our phones or apps or whatever. And I think whatever, back in the day, 10 years ago, it's like, oh, there's this app you can use and syncs all this stuff together and blah, blah, blah. And I would try that stuff, but it never actually helped anything. I would like partially set things up and then like never use it again. There's probably 3 or 4 apps that I did that with. The other thing is when you write it by hand, it like forces you to go slower anyway. And I was reading some article, I can't remember the context or any of the details, it doesn't matter, but like it was kind of about the bullet journaling method, I guess. Have you tried that? Are you familiar?
I am familiar with it, but I have never tried it.
So similar to the apps, I kind of started doing it, but I kept it up for much longer. It's a lot more adaptable than some of the, what I felt like the apps were driving me towards. Anyway, in the article, it mentioned the bullet journaling method kind of forces you to do like repetitive things. So let's say you have a task and you didn't complete it that day, you would need to carry it over to the next day and like rewrite it. So it like forces you to think, well, I skipped it for 4 days in a row. Am I really going to do this? Does it actually matter? And then things just fall off. So anyway, I have a bunch of like paper notebooks and it looks like you snatched that from like there was a young girl that wanted to get the Hello Kitty notebook from the library, and then you took it away from her or something like that.
I probably sort of left it there for someone who would have appreciated it more than I did.
But it was sitting there. No one picked it up. I'm sure you didn't take it from a kid, probably. So yeah, I like paper notebooks. Now, for our writing, so we're writing the books and working on that stuff. What do you use the written, like handwritten notebooks for in the writing process?
Whenever I have ideas, I get out my notebook and write it down. So this thing has turned into pages and pages of disorganized notes and thoughts. So then I have to open my computer and find a way to make sense of them all. Like all the time throughout the day, I'm always thinking about the book and other things. And if I don't write it down, it's super annoying because I'll remember that I had a great thought, but I have no idea what the thought was. And it usually doesn't come back to my brain unless I can try to go down whatever line of thought I had at that time. I can't resurface it. So whenever I do have a good thought, I need to write it down immediately. And that's what I use the notebook for.
I can't remember if it was Stephen King or someone else who was like, don't even worry about that. If it's a really good idea, you'll have it again.
That is not the case with me.
I don't know. Maybe I'll look that up. That could be a section in the book. Because I've tried, you know, I bring a notebook around in my pocket sometimes and try to write stuff. And then either I forget or the times that I write it down, it's in the notebook. I never get it out of there. So if it's a good one, I'll have it again. I'll just count on the universe to make sure it resurfaces. I don't know.